Hi there, it's Ed here with a short message before we start the pod this week. Did you know that our most informed investors get insights, articles, and investment ideas from Tom, me, and the team sent directly to them via email, and it is completely free. You can join them. Just subscribe at fidelity.co.uk/newsletters. Hello and welcome to the Personal Investor Podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, we're taking the temperature of markets after a weekend of worrying geopolitical news. How will the tension in the Middle East affect economies, and what can or should investors do to mitigate geopolitical risk? And then our semi-regular check in on premium bonds. What is the case for them now? If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. Ever since the war between Israel and Hamas broke out last October, there has been a fear that the fighting could widen across the region. Events this past weekend seem to confirm those fears coming true. Against that backdrop, a significant negative reaction in financial markets was perhaps to be expected. So, what has that reaction been, and what can or should investors do in the face of such extreme geopolitical risks? To talk it over, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, Investment Director here at Fidelity. Tom, welcome along. We're also going to be looking at something completely unrelated to geopolitics today. And that's the case for premium bonds. But let's start with events in the Middle East, shall we? Let's say at the start here that the reaction of economies, let alone investments, really isn't the biggest priority right now, given what's going on. But this is the dominant issue facing markets this week, so we should focus on it, I think. So why don't you begin, Tom, with taking us through how markets have reacted to this news?
Yes, well, it is quite difficult to disaggregate the market reaction from what's going on, because, of course, lots of different things are going on at the same time. But having said that, I think it's fair to say that the markets peaked a week or so ago, and since then they've fallen by 2 or 3%, and obviously that is in part related to what's been going on in the Middle East. I think since the weekend, the reaction of the markets has been, I'd say, relatively muted. Certainly within the stock markets, a little bit of a fall yesterday, but again, as I say, difficult to disaggregate from what else is going on, because, you know, we had some retail sales figures yesterday. So, you know, overall, I'd say in summary, you know, markets have not responded, you know, too badly to what's been going on. The reaction has been relatively calm.
It's funny, isn't it? It feels like markets are sort of making their mind up. And it can be like this, can't it? When sort of, you know, very important seeming geopolitical news happens, markets can be sort of eerily, oddly quiet. And then they can suddenly react when the news, you know, seems to get sort of incrementally a bit worse. They may eventually react to take notice of what's going on, but the timing of it is really uncertain, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And you know, if you look back a couple of years to what happened after the invasion of Ukraine, I mean, we had a reasonably strong market reaction initially, and then actually for the rest of the year, we saw big falls in markets. But, you know, to what extent was that a reaction to what was going on within Ukraine? And to what extent was it a reaction to other related economic events, such as the spike in energy prices, the spike in inflation that accompanied that, the rise in interest rates that accompanied that? You know, yes, they're related, but, you know, to what extent can you really link them? It's difficult to say.
Yeah, and actually that comparison with Russia and Ukraine is quite informative, isn't it? Because back then you had events on the ground leading to direct impacts on economies, and that was to do with energy supply and inflation. That intersected with what was going on with monetary policy, adding to a cost of living crisis, and then you can see how that sort of fed through to markets. If you were going to sort of conduct a similar exercise with what's going on in the Middle East, what would you say? What are the assets that are more directly impacted, and, you know, where does the impact of this show up?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point, because, you know, what we've seen over the last few days is we have seen a reaction within certain assets, and I'd sort of focus on three, really. I think The gold price has risen very sharply. It had been rising for a while. I mean, the gold price has been it's at an all-time high now, and it has been rising for 18 months or so. But there's been a very significant upward shift very recently. So I think that, you know, we can link that with what's going on in the Middle East. The other asset, I think, which is clearly important in this regard is oil. We've seen a big rise in the oil price from about $75 a barrel at the beginning of the year to about $90 a barrel currently. And given the location of what's going on, you know, I think that is clearly related. And then the third asset, I think, which is worth noting, is the movement in the US dollar. So the US dollar tends to be a safe haven at times of uncertainty. There are other factors affecting the dollar, most notably what's happening with the differential between interest rates in different countries in the world. So that's obviously, you know, worth mentioning. But I think that, you know, when there is uncertainty, there is a tendency to move towards the dollar, and the dollar has appreciated quite significantly as well. So I think those are the three key assets which are really moving at the moment.
Yeah, and as you say there, this is all going on at a time when there's actually in the background a sort of shifting expectation around interest rates around the world, isn't there? And let's just sort of recap that. Higher interest rates typically for in the US would lead to a higher US dollar, is that fair to say, particularly when that's relative to other regions?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, as the expectation that interest rates will remain higher for longer in the US was cemented last week when we had a stronger inflation print in the US than was expected. And all other things being equal, higher for longer interest rates would lead to higher bond yields, and that makes dollar assets more attractive to investors. So that would lead to a stronger dollar.
Okay, and there's an impact, isn't there, of a stronger dollar that's relative or that's relevant, I should say, to the UK, which is that it can often benefit the headline index, can't it? Because there's so many companies which earn their money in dollars.
Well, that's right. And in fact, it's a double benefit for the UK market, because not only do many of the biggest companies in the UK earn a high proportion of their profits in dollars, and so therefore, as they are translated back into sterling, that is a benefit for the bottom lines of those companies, and therefore for their share prices. So that's one benefit. The other benefit, of course, is that the UK market is quite heavily weighted towards precisely these sort of hard assets, oil and gas commodities, which are doing well in this context. So for two reasons, I think this has actually helped the UK, relatively speaking.
Yeah, and we'll always try to focus on what investors should do about all of these things. Is there anything that they should particularly do in the face of these geopolitical events? It's funny, they can, you know, obviously at the extreme you have, you know, the outbreak of war and violence, and that can naturally cause a lot of nervousness. But I guess history would tell us that markets, of course, can react to those things, but they can also react to many other things as well. Is there any reason to view geopolitical risk as different from any other type of risk?
No, I don't think so. And I think it's also important to maintain a degree of detachment from what's going on, and certainly from the emotional side of what's going on, because clearly there are many factors operating at the same time. And I mentioned the inflation figures last week. I mentioned the retail sales figures. And I would say that those have probably actually had a greater impact on the stock market than what's going on in the Middle East. For one thing, they're easier to understand. They're easier to read. I mean, there's so much uncertainty about what's going on geopolitically that it makes it difficult to really make a sensible judgment about what the impact is going to be on economies and on markets. Whereas I think if you look at the numbers around inflation and around retail sales and unemployment and all of those factors, it's easier to get a grip on the likely impact that's going to have on the future trajectory of interest rates, which at the moment is probably the key determinant of where markets head.
Okay, well, this story is obviously playing out and it's bound to change again. So I dare say we will revisit it again in the future, Tom. But let's leave it there for now, because I did say that we'd talk about something else today. And if it isn't too much of a gear change, Tom, I wanted to revisit premium bonds, a topic that we have discussed on the pod at various times and I've certainly written about. They are the most popular way for people in Britain to save money, believe it or not. But do they actually make sort of financial sense? It's a question that I've been thinking about because 3 years ago, as I have spoken about on the pod before, I moved some of my cash savings into premium bonds, Tom. And back then, there was a fairly good rationale for doing it, which I'm going to run through today. But now the equation may have changed somewhat. So I guess I'm going to do a lot of the talking here, Tom. So why don't you jump in at this point and give listeners a bit of a crash course on how premium bonds work before I get into my experience with them?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, happy to do that. So, yeah, I mean, essentially, you know, premium bonds are a mechanism for saving. They, in some ways, they look similar to a savings account, but they're fundamentally different. And the essential difference is that premium bonds represent a prize draw. So you buy a premium bond. Each premium bond has a value of £1. I think there's a minimum investment. I think you can't buy less than £25 worth of bonds. But each of those £1 bonds is entered into a monthly draw, and stands to win a prize of between £25 and £1 million, or it might win nothing at all. I mean, most of them will win nothing at all. So where the similarity with a savings account lies is that there is a notional interest rate attached to premium bonds, which is set by the government through National Savings and Investments. And at the moment, I think it's between 4.4%. Okay, it's between 4 and 5%. But that is the important point to note about that is that that is an average. That is the return that the government is paying out on all the premium bonds in issue. So some people will gain much more than 4.4% because they'll win one of the bigger prizes. Most people will receive much less than that. But it's fair to say that if you have enough of them, and I think the limit is £50,000 that you can invest in premium bonds, if you have, you know, towards the top end of that, then you are likely to, on average, get a return close to that 4.4%. So that's the way in which it's a bit like a savings account, but of course the mechanism is fundamentally different.
Yes, very good, Tom. Very good indeed. I'll just supplement that in a couple of ways. Yeah, this prize fund rate, it's called. As you say, that's an average return from premium bonds, but an average means that some people are going to get much less or much more than that. And as you suggest there, the maths around premium bonds are really complicated. I won't pretend to completely understand them or to have worked them out for myself, but sources that I trust suggest that when you have approaching, I don't know, £15,000, £20,000 held in premium bonds, and you have the average amount of luck, then you should get close to the advertised prize rate. And NS&I, as you say, the body that controls the premium bonds, they can up and they can sort of increase and decrease that rate through the prizes on offer and the kind of how the draw works, essentially. So let's move on to my experience with all this. Tom, you just jump in with questions as they occur to you. Let's do it that way, I think. Okay, let's go back to 3 years ago, 2021, and I decided to move a chunk of money, rainy day money, let's call it, into premium bonds. This is the money that I keep alongside. It's not invested. It's not sort of part of that pot. It's the sort of 3 to 6 months of income that is sensible to have on hand. And a good idea for investors and everyone to have on hand if they can. And back then, interest rates were incredibly low, as I'm sure listeners will remember. And on the cash savings options that I had before me back then, I think I was getting about 0.5% on my savings. And back then, premium bonds, the rate was 1%. Twice as much. So it was a pretty clear-cut decision back then that premium bonds made a lot of sense. Now, What's happened since then, of course, is that interest rates all over the place, you know, central banks and in the market have risen. We've covered it lots and lots and lots. So now, as you say, the rate on premium bonds has jumped to 4.4%. It had actually been a little bit higher. They reduced it a month or two back, but it stands at 4.4%. But importantly, in that comparison with cash savings accounts, it does not look as favourable anymore. So the best cash ISAs, which is a pretty good comparison to make, I'll come on to explain why, but cash ISAs pay, the best ones at least, pay above 5%. And the best cash savings accounts outside of ISAs pay even a little bit more than that. So,
and it's probably worth, Ed, actually just pointing, just explaining how the government sets that rate, because yes. I mean it's doing that within sort of certain constraints, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not just, it isn't able just to sort of, you know, pick and choose what rate it wants to pay. It has a remit, basically. It's a government-backed savings provider, is NS&I, and they have a couple of roles. They obviously want to offer a savings home for UK citizens, which is 100% backed by the government, no kind of commercial risk of going bust. But this money that people save through premium bonds, but also through cash savings bonds, other savings products, the government can use that as a source of funding for the Treasury, essentially. A bit like a bank is able to sort of put your savings deposits to use. You obviously have complete access to it, but that's what it can be used for. So it's a useful thing for the government. But what it can't do is give a bad deal to taxpayers, because obviously it is government backed. It couldn't just give savers an incredibly high rate at the expense of taxpayers. And also, and this is probably the least understood part of it, it's not supposed and it's not allowed to distort the commercial market for savings too much. It can't outcompete all the commercial providers, make their job sort of unprofitable suddenly. It's not there to do that, and it has a remit to protect against doing that. So when it sets its rates, it sort of has to sort of pick and judge a moment and a point for the prize fund rate on premium bonds to satisfy all those sort of competing considerations.
Which means that it's going to be a broadly competitive rate. It's not going to be way out of line with what you can get elsewhere. It may be a bit higher or a bit lower. As you say, 3 years ago it was a bit higher. Now it's a bit lower.
Yeah, that's right. So we can cut to the chase, really, and say that there's a very strong case for not holding premium bonds right now versus other cash savings. And that's certainly how I'm looking at it. But there are some other considerations here, and chiefly they consider tax, because the prizes on premium bonds are completely tax-free. Now, cash savings, you do potentially have to pay tax on your interest. That's not true if you hold your cash in an ISA, but as we know, there's only a certain amount per year that you can put in ISAs of any kind, £20,000. And if you're determined to use as much of that as you can for investments, anything you put in cash detracts from that. There is allowance for you to earn some interest without tax applying outside of an ISA, but those very low at the moment, and it's been coming down. So it depends on your tax band more widely. But if you were a basic rate taxpayer, I think you can have £1,000 in savings interest. If you're a higher rate taxpayer, you can have £500. And the 45p rate taxpayers, they don't get any allowance. So any interest that they earn outside of ISAs on savings is going to be taxed at income tax rates, which, you know, completely changes the equation, frankly, when you're trying to decide on where you put your cash savings. So, long story short, if you have unused cash ISA allowance or ISA allowance in general, and you can put it and you can use it for cash, and you don't have to forego investments if that's what you want to do, cash ISAs are a pretty good place to be right now, particularly if you're in the higher tax bands. But if you're not, if that's not the case for you, if you don't have the allowance, then actually premium bonds are still pretty good, because that tax-free return is very, very valuable. And a few percentage points lower rates in prizes is probably outweighed by the fact that you don't have to pay tax. And one further point here, I mean, just it's been interesting looking at this over the past few years. One of the things I found is that it's actually quite difficult. If you have premium bonds, it's very difficult to work out whether or not you've actually got the price rate or not, because I can look back on the returns that I've, you know, the prizes that I've won, and I've won a bunch. You know, that every month you're hopeful that you'll get the text message from NS&I saying that you've won a prize, and you log into your account, and you know, you might have, you know, a 25 or multiple £25 prizes, maybe even a 50 or a £100 prizes. My best ever was £1,000, Tom, all in one go. But if I look back on the whole of the 3 years and work out what the overall return has been, it's something like just over 3% a year. But of course, that it's difficult to say whether that's better or worse than the advertised rate, because it's moving. It's 4.4 now, but it was 1%, and it's shifted in increments throughout that time. So actually working out how you're doing when it comes to premium bonds is a little bit tricky.
It does sound though that you've had a reasonable return on your savings, and of course, you know, at the same time you have given yourself the chance of having, you know, a life-changing win. So it doesn't sound like you regret what you did three years ago.
I don't regret it. And taken together, given all those factors that I've gone on about, you know, with tax and all the rest of it, I think probably I will end up keeping some money in premium bonds. I think that's going to make sense from a financial point of view, providing I continue to get, broadly speaking, the level of luck in these prize draws that I have so far. And yes, you are right. I will admit, you know, that sort of daydream of winning big is... I mean, it's highly unlikely. I think it's even more unlikely you win big on premium bonds than it is on the lottery. So it's not really a realistic prospect. But, you know, it's nice to dream at the same time.
Yes, I wonder what the odds are. I mean, it's presumably millions to one.
Multiple millions to one. Yeah, there's so many in issuance that, yeah, the chances of yours coming up. But, I mean, it is a monthly draw every single month. So, you know... It's a sort of nice daydream, as I say. One sort of practical thing I probably am going to do is I will look closely at how I'm using my ISA allowance. And I mean, look, ideal world, you'd be able to have lots and lots of money on hand to just put it all in investments where you think you'll get the best return. But if there is unused allowance, I'm gonna use it for tax. From a practical point of view, perhaps the easiest way to do that, actually, you can hold money in what's notionally a stocks and shares ISA, but you can use cash-like investments within that. You can use cash funds, money market funds, short-dated bond funds. Now, you have to, you know, consider that you might be paying additional charges to have your money held in that way. But if it's just the case of having exposure to cash in a very fluid sort of way, that's a good option, and I think I will use that option for my cash savings. And just finally, Tom, it is important to put this cash to use, isn't it? Because unlike 3 years ago, rates are at a level now, and inflation has been at a level now, where if you don't do that, it's going to be losing value, and that can be quite painful in the long term.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, holding cash, if you're a long-term investor, if you're investing on a longish time horizon, it really doesn't make sense to hold more cash than you need to. I mean, and you mentioned at the beginning that there is a good case for holding, you know, 3 to 6 months worth of cash for those rainy day situations where you lose income for a short period of time, whatever. But as an investment, yes, at the moment you can get 4 or 5% on your cash, which is largely keeping up with inflation at the moment. But you're unlikely over the long haul to beat inflation with cash.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, Tom, thanks for bearing with me on my adventures in premium bonds. That is all the time we have for now. Thanks for joining me.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week.
Please note that the value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. Investors should note that the views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon. This information is not a personal recommendation for any particular investment. If you are unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to one of Fidelity's advisors or an authorized financial advisor of your choice. Overseas investments will be affected by movements in currency exchange rates, and investments in emerging markets can be more volatile than other more developed markets. Reference to the specific securities should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities and is included for the purposes of illustration only. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and all tax rules may change in the future. Withdrawals from a pension product may not be possible until you reach age 55, 57 from 2028. This podcast may not be reproduced or circulated without prior permission. No statements or representations made in this podcast are legally binding on Fidelity or the recipient. This podcast is meant only for UK residents and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation in any jurisdiction in which it may be unlawful to make such an offer or solicitation.